Begin after six taps. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Howdy, pilgrims. You're listening to the FlixWise podcast. I'm your host, Card Shark Lady P. No relation to Master P. And just coming in off the stage is author, film historian, and friend of the show, Professor Joseph McBride. Welcome back to FlixWise, Joe.
Well, it's good to be back in town.
Yeah. we have to work on our Old West, you know, tobacco chewing.
Right. It's got off the stagecoach together.
Yeah, different
stagecoaches going different directions.
Yes, exactly. Right. Okay, so at this point, I'm sure many of our listeners have started to notice a pattern in your appearances. McBride's on the show, must be talking some Titan of early to mid-century American cinema. And if that was indeed your line of thinking, well, you're not wrong. Joe has written extensively about many of the great directors of the classic Hollywood era, including John Ford, Orson Welles, Billy Wilder. And if you'll recall, he's been here for our previous shows on The Searcher, Some Like It Hot, and our Welles Centennial. But unfortunately, we haven't yet had an opportunity to talk about Joe's work on Howard Hawks. That is, until now. Today's Sight and Sound entry is Hawks' great 1959 Western/hangout movie, Rio Bravo. Still can't believe it's taken this long for a Hawks movie to show up on this list. Get it together, critics. We're going to talk Hawks and his various forays into the Western genre, and discuss whether we think Rio Bravo is indeed the crowning achievement of his long and multifaceted career. And speaking of great early Hollywood directors, have you guys heard the good news about Orson Welles' long unfinished masterpiece, The Other Side of the Wind? Looks like the pieces are finally coming together, and we might actually get to see it. Our guest Joe has been a longtime champion of the film, as well as one of its featured players. So we're going to talk to him about where the project stands and how he's feeling now that people may, at long last, get to watch this thing. And then we'll close things out with some updates on Joe's writing projects. All right, Joe, you got the dynamite ready?
Yeah,
right. Do it.
Got Walt running ready to throw the dynamite. Dynamite.
Oh, yes. We're getting started early. Here we go. For today's Sight and Sound entry, we have Howard Hawks' 1959 feature, Rio Bravo. While the film indulges in all the trappings of a classic Hollywood-era Western, shootouts, barroom brawls, no-good outlaws, and wide-brimmed black hats, the primary pleasure of Rio Bravo is getting to watch a handful of cool dudes, plus Ricky Nelson, chill and relate for a couple of hours. The chief cool dude in this story is John T. Chance, played by ultimate cowboy, Mr. John Wayne. John T., or Chance as he's primarily known, is one of two sheriffs policing a small Texas town called, you guessed it, Rio Bravo. The other sheriff helping to keep law and order in this old West City is a drunken laughingstock named Dude, who's played by Dean Martin. And the two of them are assisted by a peg-leg deputy named Stumpy, who's played by the one and only Walter Brennan. Dude, the Dean Martin character, was once the greatest shot in the land, but now can't keep his hand still long enough to aim. Instead, he passes the night curled up on a barroom floor, begging local townsfolk for shots of whiskey. That is until one night, a no-good nicknamed Joe Burdett cruelly tosses a silver dollar into a spittoon and implores Dude to dig it out. This instigates a series of violent events, which culminates in Chance and Dude arresting Joe for the murder of an innocent bystander. Unfortunately for them, Joe comes from a family with real deep pockets, and when his brother Nathan learns of Joe's incarceration, he's able to buy every decent gunslinger this side of the Mississippi in order to surround the jail in an effort to intimidate Chance into letting Joe go free. The remainder of the film involves the central trio, Chance, Dude, and Stumpy, waiting around for the marshal to come to town and take Joe away before someone gets hurt. While they wait, Dude struggles to overcome his alcoholism, and Chance refuses outside help, insisting that he's the sheriff and needs to take this burden on himself. Well, him and Ricky Nelson, he can come too. And what is a Hawks movie without a brassy, tomboyish dame to fall for? In this incarnation, her name is Feathers, and she's played by the lovely Angie Dickinson. Feathers and Chance dance around each other for a couple hours until finally they relent and admit that they actually like each other. The film comes to a boil with an explosive showdown between our heroes and the gunslingers, but the primary action is less about gunpowder and more about the interplay between the various characters. The playful ribbing of longtime pals, the flirtatious code-skirting banter of Chance and his lady love, these are the reasons to watch Rio Bravo. Well, that and because Walter Brennan is the best, like, objectively. As I mentioned, this is the 63rd movie on the Sight and Sound Critics poll, and the first appearance of any Hawks film on the list. It's a great one, to be sure, but is it 63 good? We shall discuss. All right, Joe, what do you think? Rio Bravo, pretty solid?
Well, Robin Wood, who's one of the critics I most admire, said if you had to pick one film to justify the existence of Hollywood, it would be Rio Bravo.
Yeah, that's quite a compliment.
Yeah. And so 63 seems kind of low to me, but it's the quintessential Hawks film, I think.
Interesting.
He made so many great movies. You know, one of the things that distinguished him was that he made some of the best movies in several genres, which is unusual. And yet they're all very similar because he has certain preoccupations and situations and characters and even lines of dialogue that keep getting repeated from film to film. And so that's part of the fun of a Hawks film. It's like when you see a Ford film, you go to see his stock company, and when you go to a Hawks film, you go to hear a woman say, it's even better if you help, and things like that, you know.
Where was the first appearance of I'm Hard to Get, You Just Have to Ask? Was that Only Angels Have Wings?
Well, yeah, it's hard to, you know, I'm not sure, I'd have to trace all that. I think Gene Arthur says it in Only Angels Have Wings, and Angie Dickinson has a variation, but there's a line that Hawks mentioned. He was, I spent 7 years talking to him, and I did a book called Hawks on Hawks, and I did this partly because I was a screenwriter and I wanted to learn from him. He was a great master of storytelling, and I asked him how he did dialogue, and he said when the screenwriters thought they were finished, like Ben Hecht and Charles MacArthur, he would say, well, let's spend another 3 days just saying in different ways, saying crazy things. And so they had a lot of fun, and a lot of that dialogue winds up in the film. And it's, he said, for example, instead of characters saying, oh, you're just in love, have them say, oh, you're just broke out in monkey bites. And he said, you know what it's, you know what they're saying, but it's a funny way of saying it.
That's true.
And but then I found that line goes back to the 20s. There's a silent film in which a Hawks character says that. And so it wasn't Hector MacArthur. But, you know, that's one of the fun parts of Hawks is he takes a genre and then he does all kinds of riffs on it and inflections. It's like a jazz performer in a sense.
Yeah. Well, let's specifically talk about his Westerns. This is not his first Western. It is not his last Western. But do you think it's the quintessential Hawks Western? I guess you think this film is the quintessential Hawks film, so maybe this is kind of a redundant question.
Yeah, right.
But why do you think this one stands out above the rest?
Well, you know, I personally love El Dorado the best of all Hawks films. And El Dorado was...
El Dorado's your favorite Howard Hawks film?
Yeah,
wow.
Yeah.
Even
though I say Rio Bravo is the quintessential Hawks film, I think that's true because it's the essence of Hawks in one film. If you had to show one film to people to say who is this guy, El Dorado is a very beautiful film, and it's kind of a takeoff on Rio Bravo, where he and the writer Lee Brackett, who wrote Rio Bravo with Jules Furthman, Hawks said when they came to a certain situation, they'd have two or three different variations, and they would pick one but remember the other ones, and so they inverted some of the things, like in Rio Bravo, Dean Martin's the deputy and he's a drunk. So in El Dorado, they made Robert Mitchum the sheriff and he's a drunk.
Right.
And his friend who helps him is John Wayne. And I like the autumnal quality of El Dorado and the pictorial beauty of it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very funny, but Rio Bravo is very funny too. It's just Rio Bravo is one of the greatest screenplays ever written, I think. Just a tremendous dialogue. And the situation is very tense because it takes place in about 3 days and it's highly pressurized.
Mm-hmm.
And so it has that unity of time and place, which El Dorado doesn't have. It's more sprawling. which is good too. But right. And then he made a third version, Real Lobo, which is not as good. Unfortunately, it's his last film, and it's very uneven because some of the young actors weren't very good. But he's got some great set pieces in it, and it's more violent even than the other ones, and some of the action scenes are terrific. But anyway, so but Rio Bravo was made, as many people know, partly in reaction to High Noon. Hawks didn't like High Noon, and I have to agree with him. I know a lot of people love High Noon, and it's got some great moments, but he said he didn't think a good sheriff would run around town like a chicken with his head cut off asking people for help. Mm-hmm. And he felt that he valued professionalism very highly. A lot of Hawks's code, it was Jacques Rivette said that Howard Hawks is the only American director who knows how to draw a moral, which is not totally true because, you know, I mean, John Ford can do that or Capra. Mm-hmm. But Hawks's films are about a professional code or a code of behavior. And I think a lot of it he got from Hemingway. And one of the things Hemingway values and Hawks values is professionalism. And they don't like amateurs coming along. And if you're a professional sheriff, you know, you do your job and you take the risks and you use the best people you can have to help you, even if they're a drunk and a cripple, as he points out in the film. And there's a wonderful line where Ward Bond says, is that who you got? And Wayne says, he says, is that all you got? And he says, that's what I've got.
Yeah.
Which is terrific because, you know, that expresses a philosophy that you make the best of what you have. And also he trusts these guys, even though they have character flaws, they're good in a pinch.
Right.
And so that comes across in the film, whereas in High Noon, the sheriff is extremely indecisive, and the townspeople are all cowards. And it's kind of an allegory of the blacklist, which makes sense. Hawks was a conservative guy politically, as was, of course, John Wayne. But I think it, in terms of the Western ethos, I like the sense of responsibility that he has for on his characters, and the fact that they're not looking for well-meaning amateurs, as John Wayne puts it, because, for example, Ward Bond, who's getting old in the film, and he's his friend, volunteers to go out and get him some help, and Wayne says, what would I have a bunch of well-meaning amateurs who are worried about their wives and children? And he said, not one of their lives would be worth, you know, the outlaw's life. Mm-hmm. And then Bond goes out and tries to, after he's volunteered to help him, he gets shot immediately, you know.
Right.
That's Hawks's way of saying, here's what happens if you're a well-meaning guy who tries to help. But the irony of Hawks's films, one of the things that makes them poignant is that John Wayne, like a lot of Hawks characters, thinks he's very self-sufficient, but he's not. And people are helping him all the time. He's trying to turn down help, but Ricky Nelson helps him. Angie Dickinson comes along and helps him. There are many scenes in the film in which he wouldn't survive without people helping him. And that's a kind of a nice irony and motif throughout Hawks, that the group is essential. One guy can't do it alone. You have to have a lot of help and friends. And his films are a lot about friendship, and I find that very moving. The thing I like best about it, I suppose, I mean, two things. One is the relationship between John Wayne and Dean Martin is so moving, where Dean Martin gives a great performance and Wayne is helping rehabilitate him, but in a very sensitive way, but not in an indulgent way too. I mean, he's tough on him when he needs to be. It's kind of tough love, but he's also very kind to him. And he's, you know, Dean Martin has to kind of get himself together, and you can't do that for somebody else. And then the relationship with Angie Dickinson is very sophisticated. She's one of the most sophisticated Hawks women. She was very young at the time. And she's the interplay they have is very complex. And it's as you kind of alluded to, a sort of a dance between male-female couple. And Wayne has this situation, which is typical of Hawks, that he's kind of afraid of women and shy around women. Hawks like that. It gives humor to his films to have a big guy like John Wayne be kind of afraid of women. Right. But it's also part of the American problem for males, that insecurity or unwillingness to commit. And so the women in Hawks films are very aggressive sexually, which appeals to people today. It seems very modern that women are not just kind of passive in the background, like in a lot of old films, but they're very forthright about sensuality and what they want. You know, they're demanding what they want.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, Angie Dickinson, it seems so obvious now, but she's a perfect Hawks heroine. But I will say, I feel this might be a little sacrilegious, but I also kind of prefer El Dorado. And I can't really, I don't even really know why. I guess I like how sprawling it is.
Mm-hmm.
And it really doesn't feel like there's you know, the stakes are high, but it's so episodic almost that it doesn't build to this kind of the same kind of climax. And I don't know, I guess the love story in that is so sidelined that it's it's almost more streamlined, which I know, yeah. It's a little bit it's almost an art film. It's just kind of, we're going to hang out here in the Old West. I have a bullet in my back. I don't know.
It's very, very moving in terms of dealing with old age and infirmity, sure. Too. And yeah. Hawks is often focused on characters' physical infirmities. In Rio Bravo, it's the alcoholism and the Stumpy being a cripple. And El Dorado, John Wayne is the cripple. He's got a bullet in his back and he has these spasms that look like heart attacks or strokes. Mm-hmm. And it's very, very moving about how he's slowing down. As Hawks said, you know, he takes longer to get up on his horse now than he used to.
Right.
And it's one of those films that is sort of an elegy for the Old West. And, the love story in that is not as compelling. Charlene Hold is very appealing and brassy, but it doesn't count for as much as the one with Angie Dickinson, who's more emotionally outgoing. And Wayne's vulnerability is tested more in Rio Bravo, but Mitchum is extremely funny. And
oh, I love Mitchum in that film.
Yeah.
He's terrific. And I will say, John Wayne's a little bit more playful in Rio Bravo.
It's a more playful film in a sense. And I mentioned to Hawks, I said this thing about it's more sprawling. And he said, yeah, but it's got an awfully good story that he felt tied everything together, that Wayne hears that his friend has become a drunk and he comes back to town to help him and he's offered a job as a hired gunman, and then he shoots a kid in the back, which is one of the most moving scenes in a Hawks, or shoots him in the stomach, I'm sorry, he shoots a kid who's standing guard, and then he has to bring the body back to his father, which is a very powerful scene. And then it gets funnier and funnier, and James Caan is hilarious in the film.
James Caan is terrific, and I think if Rio Bravo has any kind of weak point, it is... It's the Colorado character.
Well,
it's like a canny bit of stunt casting. You know, it works, but once you see James Caan in that role, that just makes so much more sense.
Yeah, I mean, Hawks said to me, I said, how did you get James Caan to be so funny? I worked with James Caan, who's not, let's say, the sharpest tool in the tool. And he said, well, I never told him he was supposed to be funny.
Ah.
So Caan came to him late in the filming and said, hey, this is funny stuff. And he said, well, if I had told you, you would have acted it out.
Right. Yeah.
And so this is funny. Whereas I have to say, with Ricky Nelson, when I was 12, I saw Rio Bravo in the theater. And I told Hawks that the reason I went to see it was because Ricky Nelson was in it. And Hawks said, well, I didn't know you had such good taste in music. Ricky Nelson was a big TV star on the Ozzie and Harriet show, and he started singing songs on the show. He had a beautiful voice, really, and at the end of the show, he'd always do a musical number, and all the kids would flip out. And he's very callow in the film. Hawks directs him kind of like Montgomery Clift in Red River, but Clift has more substance, and he's a stronger actor, obviously. But I find Colorado kind of appealing. He's a cocky young guy, and he's not a great actor, but he has a nice presence. And Wayne and Hawks integrates him well. Hawks' films are kind of like an extended family. That's another reason people like them. It's not the nuclear family. Hawks didn't care about marriage and nuclear families and children, like Ford did, for example. He has ad hoc families, which is very much the way people are today. And so you have John Wayne as the father figure, Stumpy the grandfather figure, and Colorado as the child or the kid, teenage kid. And then Angie Dickinson is, you know, the girlfriend, right, who's quite young. I saw an interview with her where she said, did you think it was kind of odd for you to be cast against a guy who was a lot older? And she said she never thought of John Wayne as older. She said he was very comfortable to play with and very cozy, she said. And so she never thought of the age distinction. She seems a lot more mature than her very young age. Mm-hmm. And he seems kind of boyish. Hawks's men are kind of boyish, and that's good and bad. I mean, I think the limitation of Hawks sort of is the somewhat immature worldview that he has about what a man is and what life is about, although there is this existential code that he has, which is powerful. But he's limited in his themes compared to somebody like Ford, who's a much broader artist. But within his range, Hawks is great. I mean, one of the things that I think the thing I like best about Hawks is the interplay between the characters, the little moments they have, mm-hmm, that are kind of either unscripted or inspired, like when Stumpy is complaining at one point. He sits in his chair and he's moaning about, oh, how come everybody's talking about dude all the time? What about me? You know, I never get any thanks. I don't get no gratitude. And Wayne says, Stumpy, you're a treasure. And he takes off Stumpy's hat and leans over and kisses him on the head, you know.
Right, yeah. I think that's the moment of the film.
Yeah.
That's what bought that the 63rd spot.
There's so many moments like that in Hawks' films that are just wonderful character interactions. And the subtlety of the interactions between Dickinson and Wayne is marvelous. It's hard to put your finger on, but she has so many reactions where he says something and then she finds it funny and she teases him and he gets shy and then he gets stubborn. And, you know, it's just a terrific, it's the way people really act in real life, I think. Hawks brings it out. And El Dorado, there's a great moment I love when Mitchum is on has a crutch. And at the end of the film, John Wayne has a crutch too. Okay. And so they're hobbling around together. And at one point, somebody says to Mitchum, you got the crutch under the wrong arm. And Wayne says, or I guess Mitchum says that to Wayne. And Wayne says, well, how would you know? You got it first under one arm and then the other.
Yeah.
And I said to Hawks, was that a gag you threw in on the set? And he said, yeah, because, you know, we got mixed up as to what arm they were supposed to have the crutches on. It's a continuity joke. I mean, how many times have you seen a continuity gag in a film, you know?
Right.
And instead of being upset with the script girl or whatever that they got the continuity wrong, he made a character joke out of it.
Right. Yeah, and it works.
Yeah.
That movie, I was surprised at how moving I found it. Because you expect a kind of pale imitation of this great movie. Because who was anyone clamoring for a Rio Bravo remake?
Well, Hawks in his later years, you know, was having trouble keeping viable, and both he and John Ford were now dependent on John Wayne largely to keep working, because Wayne had become the biggest star in the business, and they helped make Wayne who he was. I mean, Ford pretty much discovered Wayne, and then, you know, I asked Hawks why Wayne was so grateful to them. And he said, well, you know, Ford put him in Stagecoach, I put him in Red River. Mm-hmm. And in Red River, he's tremendous. He plays this really tyrannical trail boss who's a very complex character. And Hawks told me that Ford said to him afterwards, I didn't know the big son of a bitch could act.
Right.
And that's probably true, because Ford had put him in lesser roles of less complexity up to that point. And then he suddenly started having him play an old man in Sure Yellow Ribbon and a troubled guy in Rio Grande and very complex anti-hero in The Searchers, etc. So the two of them really made Wayne's career, and Wayne was smart enough to be grateful. But so he kind of kept them going. And the genre that Hawks felt most comfortable in was the Western in later years. And he had come off Land of the Pharaohs, which I just watched again yesterday, by the way.
Yes, I wanted to ask you about Land of the Pharaohs, specifically because a friend of the show, that's his favorite Hawks film.
Really?
Or no, it's not. It's not his favorite Hawks film. His favorite Hawks film is The Thing from Another World. Huh. But he really feels like Land of the Pharaohs is an underrated masterpiece. And so he was really anxious to know what you thought of it. So,
well, I'd like to talk to him about that. It'd be interesting. I thought it was, I mean, Jack Hawkins, who plays the Pharaoh, who's awfully good, actually, kind of John Wayne. It's a lot like Red River, again, this very overbearing guy who kind of has a collapse, and then he falls for a woman who destroys him, and you know, it's somewhat anomalous for Hawks, but it's, I mean, it's got this tremendous spectacle of building a pyramid. Some of those scenes are really amazing. A huge number of extras and some great widescreen choreography. But the plot is kind of ridiculous, as Jack Hawkins said, that, you know, Joan Collins comes along, who's this very implausible floozy who turns the head of the pharaoh and destroys him, and she's completely evil. It's kind of a campy performance. And I thought that story kind of went to hell after that point.
All right.
and it is kind of stiff. Hawks was trying the Bible genre, even though it's not a religious story, because Hawks was not religious, but it's the ancient epic genre, which was very popular in that period, and it tanked, you know, it didn't do well. But it's got some, you know, it's got a lot of visual things that are powerful, and I do think the pharaoh was quite a strong character, and maybe they could have gone into more depth than his personality, but the visuals and the lighting and the production design are quite terrific. And also, it doesn't fall into a lot of the corny pitfalls of the DeMille films, except when the bad girl comes along. Mm. She's a little
That's my favorite part of the Ten Commandments, frankly.
Oh, Moses, you terrible, naughty guy.
We should get started. I love Ann Baxter so much. Anyway.
It's like Samson and Delilah with Hedy Lamarr. So it wasn't Hawks's genre, let's say.
Right.
But it is interesting that he was stretching himself, trying different things. It's a common thing in Hawks's career, if you look at it, that he would often imitate a trend that somebody else had started. Or there's some hit film would come along like Casablanca, and then he would do To Have and Have Not, which borrows heavily from Casablanca. But he makes it his own kind of film. But it wouldn't have existed if it hadn't been for the other film coming along first. And so then he does the Bible genre, and then he does what Rio Bravo really was a response to after 4 years of inactivity. And contrary to the myth that he just sat around and he said, I was trying to figure out what to do because the industry was changing. Well, that's partly true. But as Todd McCarthy points out in his well-researched Hawks biography, Hawks had a lot of projects he was trying to get off the ground during that period. He was living in Europe, but he was trying to do Hatari, for example, the film that became Hatari, but he wasn't able to get the funding. And the industry was changing a lot. But when he came back, he realized TV Westerns were the big thing. And there were something like 26 Westerns on prime time at one time in that era. And but Hawks noticed that the audience seemed to like TV Westerns. So Rio Bravo looks kind of like a TV Western. You know, it takes place in a limited town set, you know, obviously a set. And there's very little landscape. And a number of the actors are cast from TV series. Walter Brennan was a TV star at the time, and John Russell, who plays Nathan Burdett, was a television Western guy. And but it was like a very high-class version of a TV Western. But he makes the claustrophobia and the stylization work for him. It's a very stylized film. And as Wood says, it's the quintessential genre film. It's got all those genre elements that you catalog. And yet it's a highly personal film at the same time. And screenwriter Sam Hamm came to my screenwriting class, and he said recently, you know, I said, well, Hollywood is making mostly genre films today. How do you feel about that as a writer? He said, well, that's true, but you can do a lot within the genre framework if you're smart. You can make personal statements if you satisfy the audience for what they came to see. And it appealed to the audience at the time. It did very well, Rio Bravo, and revitalized Hawks' career. And I visited the location. He actually shot it in Old Tucson, which was a Western town that they had built. It was the film Arizona in 1940 with Gene Arthur. They built this Western town, and some guy bought it and maintained it as a Western location. And they keep having fires there. They've had two fires since I first went there, so it keeps changing all the time. But they still shoot Westerns there all the time. And all three of those late Hawks Westerns were shot there. So I love visiting that. And around it is this beautiful, you know, Western desert area with a lot of cacti and things like that. But
where is it?
It's right outside Tucson.
Oh, okay.
And you know, but it's not Hawks was not into the pictorial beauty at the time. Maybe, you know, I mean, Land of the Pharaohs, he went all out for pictorial splendor, and maybe he felt he's more comfortable with the interiors. And actually, if you look at Hawks' films, he used to be called an action director, and he's really not an action director because most of the big set pieces in his films were directed by other people, the action set pieces. There was a guy named Richard Rawson who directed a lot of them. And Hawks was mostly doing the interior stuff with people talking and interacting. But he's able to do action brilliantly. Like, there's one of the best shootouts in a Western is when they kill three or four guys on the street who are menacing them. It happens real fast. And Hawks told me he thought that's how action should be filmed, because in real life, that, you know, it's over before you even know it. You know, like the gunfight at the OK Corral took 9 seconds in real life, you know. Right. But in films, they always drag things out. And he hated the Wild Bunch, for example. He said, I can kill 4 men and bury them before Peckinpah gets one guy to fall to the street in slow motion, you know. But the staging is just so brilliant. It's over before you notice, but completely plausible, and just like in real life, you know.
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly, you know, there are the action set pieces, but the strength of his films comes from the interiors, as you say.
Yeah. That's what he really cares about, is people talking to each other, you know, people interacting, and men and women. Also, another thing about Ricky Nelson, Mike Wilmington, my former writing partner, pointed out that Ricky Nelson sort of plays the girl role in the film, in a sense that one of the things Hawks fans like about Hawks women is they're kind of like guys in a way, and I think Hawks thought of them that way. They have deep voices, and they wear pants, and they're tough and aggressive sexually, and they're very feminine as well, but they're not like the women, most of the women in those older films. But Ricky Nelson has similar qualities to Lauren Bacall and Angie Dickinson, slim hips, and his voice isn't as deep as Angie Dickinson's, but there's a kind of homoerotic quality in the Hawks canon that is completely runs through his work. And so Ricky Nelson is sort of an androgynous type of guy, which is, I think, kind of more interesting than having a real tough young gunfighter.
Sure, yeah. Yeah. I mean, you're right that there's a sort of masculinity to the female characters. There's a tomboyishness, but they're always played by very feminine women.
Yeah, Jean Arthur, Catherine Hepburn. Although Catherine Hepburn was famous androgynous, you know.
That's true, yeah. But I guess Hepburn aside, we have, you know, Lauren Bacall, Angie Dickinson.
Lauren Bacall's a pretty tough dame.
That's true. But, she had a very, very deep voice, but always pretty feminine, you know.
When I went to her apartment, I worked with her on the AFI Salute to John Huston. I went to her apartment in the Dakota Building in New York, and just to start talking with her, and she had a drink trolley there, and she said, would you like a drink? And I was drinking white wine. Then I said, yeah, I like a white wine. She kind of made a face, you know, like that's for sissies or whatever, you know. And then I said, she said, well, I said a drink, you know. And I said, okay, how about a scotch and water? And she said, scotch, it tastes like soap. So then I thought, well, what would Bogart say? And then I said, how about a whiskey? And she said, yeah, great, you know.
Oh, my God.
She's a tough dame.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. Well, speaking of alcohol, one of the central themes of the film revolves around Dean Martin's sort of dependence on alcohol and how he uses it to kind of to drown his sorrows of losing the love of his life. And I know before we started recording, you mentioned that this movie's depiction of alcoholism was one of the things that you most appreciated about it.
Yeah, when I was 12, you know, I would go to John Wayne films and Westerns and have a good time, but they didn't really probably connect very much with the life I was leading every day as a kid. But then I saw Rio Bravo, and I was most stunned by the performance by Dean Martin, because my parents were alcoholics, so I was living with this every day, and he was completely authentic and believable. I mean, Hawks captured that so well. And the scene where he pours the drink back into the bottle made a huge impact on me. I remember that. They're playing the Mexican Deguelo, which is the song the Mexicans played to taunt the men at the Alamo into surrendering. And he pours the drink back, and it's a great moment. And there's a wonderful two-shot of John Wayne and Walter Brennan looking at him in admiration. And I remember that scene's really hit me hard. So here was probably the first film I'd ever seen that meant something to me on a deep personal level, and I really respected that.
Yeah. And the you talked about their kind of their working relationship, but on first glance, it doesn't necessarily. I wouldn't have said, judging by the guy in the late 30s and early 40 and 40s who's does all the cowboy movies with John Ford, that his persona would have fit in naturally with the overly talkative characters of a Howard Hawks film, and yet somehow it totally works.
That's a good point, because Robert Parrish, who was Ford's editor, said once, how do you get such good performances out of John Wayne? This is around the time of Stagecoach and Long Voyage Home. And Ford said, well, run those two movies and take a pad of paper and write down how many times John Wayne talks in each film. And he came back and he said he talks like 8 or 9 times in each film. Ford said, well, that's the secret, you know.
Yeah.
But actually, Wayne is very good with dialogue, and there's a lot of dialogue in Rio Bravo, and he's quite... I mean, another thing I love about Hawks' films, and this film comes across probably as good as any Hawks film in this, the characters are so intelligent. They're thinking all the time. They're plotting. They're planning. And they often have very complex strategies. You know, it's hard for these guys to hold the jail in the face of all this opposition, so they have to outthink the opposition. Mm-hmm. It's a very intelligent body of work, and Wayne conveys that very well in his actions and his silent moment. A lot of the qualities of the film, I watched it again the other day, and a lot of the best moments are just the looks that people give each other. And Ford said once, somebody said, how do you watch a movie? He said, look at the eyes. So if you look at the eyes between John Wayne and Angie Dickinson, for example, or between him and Dean Martin, that's where the real meaning comes. But the dialogue is brilliant. And but there's Hawks. Truffaut said to me that Hawks was the most intellectual of American filmmakers because he knows every what he's doing all the time, and he has a lot of general theories, and nothing is instinctual. Although, I mean, there is an instinctual quality to the behavior in the film, but Truffaut thought that it was all very carefully planned and highly intelligent, and he doesn't get enough credit for being an intellectual. But as Truffaut said, Hawks would deny he was an intellectual, and when you talk to him, he would scorn that kind of thing. It's just like with women's liberation. He claimed he didn't like women's liberation, and some people challenged him in interviews. Well, you have a lot of liberated women in your films, and he didn't quite see the paradox there.
Mm. You know, I don't know.
Yeah,
I can't even try and guess.
It's simplistic. And
yeah,
when you have a great artist like Hawks, and the women are terrific in his films, And a number of women, Molly Haskell and other people, Lee Brackett, have written very good pieces on the Hawksian woman, mm-hmm. who's so central to his work. And they're just fascinating characters. And they defy categorization. They defy conventionality. And they don't fit the cliches of their time at all. And that's why one reason these films seem so fresh and vital. You can show them today and people think, wow, they seem so modern, don't they?
Yeah. I mean, I guess we sort of touched on the political nature of the film as in relation to something like High Noon, which is kind of overtly political, or at least that has been the critical understanding of it. And so if High Noon is the anti-blacklist sort of socialist masterpiece of that era, then the opposition is naturally the conservative macho man kind of backlash.
Well,
either way, it's reductive, you know.
Yeah, it's reductive, and both films have their qualities. But I would say that Hawks is very conservative, but he didn't talk about politics much. I kept trying to get him to talk about politics, but some political viewpoints come across in his attitude towards self-reliance and a lack of respect for government and lack of respect for authority. And but you know, I mean, that comes across in some ways as a good thing today when you, I mean, you can take it in a bad way, like Reagan or Trump saying that the government is your enemy, but also having a healthy skepticism toward social structures is a good part of Fox. Mm-hmm. I think that there's also this existential quality I mentioned, that as Robin Wood pointed out, the image of a Hawks film you have is kind of a darkness surrounding light. You know, there's this pool of light or pools of light in this town. The town streets have little light coming out of the jail, light coming out of the saloon, but it's dark, surrounded by darkness. It's kind of an existential view of the world that we live in a very unforgiving, tough world. Hawks' films are very unsentimental, which makes him appealing today. So it transcends politics on that level, and I think that just to say Rio Bravo is the conservative antidote to High Noon is not, doesn't do it justice. I think, I mean, one thing, for example, the Hawks male is a very unmacho guy in some ways, even though they have positions of authority and they're good in a crisis, etc. But there's a lot of vulnerability and fear. And there's a scene where Wayne admits that he's afraid, you know. Mm-hmm. That doesn't happen a lot in Westerns.
Right.
Gary Cooper certainly does in High Noon. I mean, those films maybe have more in common than we think. You know, Gary Cooper shows a lot of fear and anxiety, but John Wayne controls it better. Maybe that's what Hawks didn't like about Gary Cooper is that he was kind of a basket case in the film. Whereas Wayne tries to keep things under control, and he's the sheriff, and that's his job. And yet, when he's alone with his friends, he's admitting his vulnerability personally, and he does with Angie Dickinson as well. But also the stress of the situation they're under seems very believable to me.
Mm, yeah. All right. Well, that seems like a pretty good place to stop. But before we do, let's touch on this one more time. Number 63. Always as arbitrary as any other number, right?
Yeah, I don't put a lot of stock in numbers. I mean, I was part of that, you know, the poll. Mm-hmm. And I didn't put it on my top 10. It's somewhere, but, you know, I mean, how do you rate films on that level? That's one of the great masterpieces of Hollywood filmmaking, and it's just a perfect film, I'd say, you know, and, well, except maybe Ricky Nelson is not the... But he's the song he and Dean Martin sing. They sing a couple songs. It's a wonderful sequence in the film. They're celebrating dude's recovery, basically. And I asked Hawks why he put Ricky Nelson in the film, and he said because he added $3 million to the box office.
Exactly. Yep. Bottom line.
When the film played in Japan, Ricky Nelson's picture was bigger than Duke's. Mm-hmm. Outside the theaters.
I mean, it's like putting Justin Bieber in your award-winning movie, you know.
But then he has him sing a song, and some people criticize the film for that, but it's one of the most charming episodes of the film. And as Robin Wood points out, he's the singing cowboy, which was a big Western archetype or cliche from the 30s, the singing cowboy. And Hawks said to me, if you have a personality, you should use it. You know, if somebody can do something, have them do it in the film. You know, if somebody can play card tricks, have them play card tricks or whatever. And if a woman can do a dance or something, or, you know, I mean, use the personality you have. And he brings out the best in the performers, whether they're great actors or limited actors, he brings out the best in them.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's not my favorite Hawks. That honor is reserved for His Girl Friday, but I can't understand why that hasn't been on the list yet. It's very frustrating.
Show on that one?
What's that?
Have you done a show on that one yet?
We have not. I think it is on the list. It's just a little further down, I believe. Uh-huh. It better be on the list.
Well, it's very popular today, and there's a wonderful Criterion restoration, as you know.
Right, right. So we got to get on that.
Yeah.
But, you know, 63 seems like a pretty good spot to me.
Yeah, as long
I got no problem with it.
You know, the top 100 of films in history is pretty darn good.
Sure, I'd say so. Listeners, please let me know if I'm misremembering this, but I'm pretty sure we've never had Joe on the show without at least a mention of Orson Welles. I'm right about that, right?
That's right. Yeah. And also, like, when is Other Side of the Wind ever coming out?
Yeah, exactly.
40-some years.
Exactly. But I'm happy to say that this episode we will continue our much-loved tradition of talking Welles, of talking about Welles' great unfinished Hollywood satire, The Other Side of the Wind. Though we will be altering our tradition slightly because instead of lamenting the ongoing legal battles that have dogged this film since Wells' death, we finally have cause to celebrate. At long last, fans might actually get a chance to view the finished project, thanks to streaming media giant Netflix. As if I didn't have enough reason to feel grateful to Netflix. But I'm getting ahead of myself here. Let's first talk about what The Other Side of the Wind is, and then it'll be obvious why listeners should start getting excited. So, Joe, can you give us a brief overview of the saga that is The Other Side of the Wind?
Sure. Well, in the story of the film, he started shooting in 1970 and finished in 76. It's all shot except for two shots that have to be done with CGI. It's Welles's return to Hollywood in that period, and he was satirizing the new Hollywood, the Easy Rider era, as we now call it. And it's about an old legendary director played by John Huston who comes back to America after living in Europe, much like Welles. And he's trying to make a comeback among the young people. And he's actually being rejected, which is what Welles felt at the time, that the young people were getting chances to make films and he wasn't. So he was resentful toward the studios, along with all the other reasons he had to resent the studios. But it takes place at his birthday party, his 70th birthday party. And he dies at the end of it, and that's not a spoiler because it's mentioned at the opening of the film, just like Kane, where he dies, you know. So it's the last day of his life, and he's based on Hemingway largely, as Welles told me, but also has elements of Howard Hawks and John Ford and Rex Ingram and other directors. And in the course of the film, you see fragments of his unfinished film. He's been shooting a very arty film, filled with sort of radical chic sex and violence, and it's Welles' spoof of Zabriskie Point, the Antonioni film, which is actually a pretty good film, but Welles didn't like Antonioni at all. And so the old man is sort of pandering to the new generation, but his leading man has walked out because the Huston character is very domineering. Also, he's exposed in the film as being a latent homosexual. And Welles was asked by his old colleague Richard Wilson, when I was standing there, Richard said, Orson, what is this movie about? And Welles said, it's an attack on machoism. And that's sort of, in Welles' mind, the essence of the film. It's undercutting the myth of the great He-Man director who's a bully. And as Welles told me, he always slept with the leading lady or the girlfriend or wife of the leading man. But in old age, the mask falls away and he falls in love with the young, beautiful leading man who walks out of the film and leaves it unfinished. So you see fragments of that in the film. And it's about self-destruction. He's kind of a King Lear-ish figure. And it's about the collapse of Hollywood and all kinds of things are going on in the film. It's a very complex, layered film.
Yeah, I can't wait to see it. Partially because it's a new Orson Welles film and I am here for a new Orson Welles film. But also, that seems like such new territory for him. What a great way to venture outside of his typical subject matter. Although, I guess there's a case to be made that sad old men are right in his wheelhouse. That's his first go around.
Most of his films are about kind of a tortured love relationship between two men. Actually, almost every Welles film. This doesn't get talked about a lot, although I've written about it. And one of them betrays the other. Betrayal is a big theme in Welles' life and career. And so in a way, it's not out of his wheelhouse, but experimentally and visually, it was a new kind of style. As Jonathan Rosenbaum points out, the film is in two styles, neither of which is Welles' own style. The framing story, the party, is shot in 16 millimeter and even 8 millimeter, and it's a spoof of cinema verite with very fast cutting and stuff. And then the film within the film is a spoof of Antonioni with very beautiful 35 millimeter imagery, but very kind of pretentious and kind of silly stuff. Welles is having fun. A lot of it is funny. And the part of the question of the editing, which will start soon, right now they're scanning the negative Technicolor. They brought it over from Paris finally, and they're cleaning it and scanning it electronically so they can edit it electronically and also to preserve the film. The real challenge is how to integrate the film within the film with the framing story, and that's not an easy question. And so they'll be working on that. But But Welles always tried something different, and that's one thing that is great about him. And he's like Stanley Kubrick in that every Stanley Kubrick film was a departure from what he'd done before, and every Welles film was too. And that's one reason both of them, when their films came out, they often were met with confusion or people didn't like them. And like 10 years later, they would say, oh, 2001 is a masterpiece. And that happened to Welles all the time because they were not repeating themselves like Hitchcock and Ford. Even though they're great artists, you kind of knew what their films were going to be like. But with Other Side of the Wind, this is very different from what people expect. And so it won't be liked by everybody because they'll say, oh, gee, it's not like Citizen Kane or something. You know, but that's a narrow point of view. And I was at the time, I thought, wow, the cutting is so fast in this film. I was worried that the audience wouldn't be able to follow it. But in recent years, of course, cutting has become so fast that the world has caught up to this film. It was way ahead of its time when it was made, but it will be quite provocative. Maybe it'll be number one on the next Sight and Sound list.
Wow.
Well, actually, I don't know. I mean, again, numbers are foolish, and to say, you know, like Peter Bogdanovich said, it's better than Citizen Kane. Well, I would never say something like that because, you know, how do you compare?
Better than Citizen Kane.
Yeah, and how do you compare one film with another? They're all, you know, Welles films are always interesting. This may not be a perfect film, but it's going to be fascinating. It's very important to him, too, because he's reflecting on his art and he's reflecting on the industry late in his life. And you know, he spent 6 years shooting the film and many years trying to finish it. The legal entanglements and financial problems were mind-boggling. There's a book by Josh Karp that deals all with that, which is amazing. And I wrote about that in Whatever Happened to Orson Welles. About a third of that is on this film. The really Byzantine problems they had with investors and legal issues, and it was finally sorted out. It took forever to make the negotiations work, and Oya Kodar, Welles's mistress, who inherited his rights to the film, finally sold her rights, which she'd been holding out for like 20 some years, but it's finally happening.
So how was it? Just Netflix had to step in and offer a big old pile of money?
Well, it was Netflix put up $5 million, which is a substantial amount of money. I was producing this project at one point in the 90s. I was trying to get it made, and Gary Graver, Welles' cameraman, and I made a deal with Showtime for $3 million. And we made a kind of a rough budget, and so now it's $5 million, partly due to inflation, although Oya's money is about the same as it would have been if she'd accepted our deal back in 98. But she and Peter Bogdanovich fired me off the project as soon as we made the deal with Showtime, and they thought they didn't need me, and then the deal immediately collapsed. So I bowed out of that project at that point. I'm really glad. I thank my lucky stars that I was not involved as a producer on this film for the last 20 years, because it would have driven me out of my mind. So Philippe Jan Rimsa, it was the guy who really made it happen, and Frank Marshall, who's a famous producer, as you know, worked with Spielberg a lot. And Philippe was the guy who really pushed this thing forward. And Frank Marshall has a lot of clout in the industry, and he was able to swing the deal partially through his prestige. And the two guys got this deal with Netflix, which is investing an awful lot of money in some very adventurous films like a new Scorsese film, et cetera. And they have a lot of dough, and they were very patient with the long negotiations. A lot of companies would have pulled out, but they see it partly as a prestige thing for them. It helps elevate them, you know, because the future is uncertain in film distribution. But one thing that's happening is Netflix and other companies are starting to stream films and release them theatrically at the same time, which used to be a taboo in the industry. But they've been doing that a little bit, and that's probably what will happen with this film. It'll have some theatrical exposure and festival exposure, but it'll be available. And I think Netflix is in more than 180 countries or something like that. So it'll be the biggest audience Welles ever had for a film.
I cannot wait. Yeah. As you know, as you mentioned, this has been long in the works. There have been many starts and stops. But at this point, are you very optimistic about the completion? Do you think it's going to be as Welles envisioned it, or as close as we can possibly get?
Well, I mean, some people were skeptical when it was announced because they've heard this so many times that, you know, it's going to come up. But this time, it really is going to come out because they made the deal, signed the contract. So I have no doubt about that. It is not Wells' cut, and it's very important to keep reminding people that. And people get confused in the public. Like, when there was a restored version of Touch of Evil in 98, I was an advisor on that, and Walter Murch made 50 edits in the film to conform with the memo that Wells wrote when he saw the Universal cut, that he wasn't allowed to do the final cut. So Murch conformed it to what Wells wanted as much as he could, and I thought that was a good thing to do. And yet Universal sold it as Wells' director's cut, which it was not. And this always happens. So unfortunately, some people will be confused. But it's our best approximation of what he would have wanted. And I say our, even though I'm not directly involved. But people like me have been pushing this for years, and a lot of people. I felt some people said, well, he edited 41 minutes. Let's just leave it at that and put it into a documentary with bits and pieces of other scenes, et cetera. But I felt he shot the entire film. He shot 19 hours of footage. Nobody's seen the entire 19 hours yet. Even Gary and Orson didn't even see it because they didn't print all the material, but it's there. And so he shot this film, and I think it would be a tragedy if it were not completed in some form rather than sitting in an archive somewhere, or even worse, rotting away in a lab and getting thrown away, because it can be put together. I mean, I thought, I'm not Walter Murch, but I could have edited this film together with the help of a professional editor because I kind of know what Wells intended. But there are many surprises left in the 19 hours that we haven't seen. And at least he left 41 minutes so we can follow the style that he established for the two different kinds of film that were going on at once. But it's a real challenge for the editor and the producers to try to approximate his vision without tampering with it too much. But you have to tamper to make it work, you know. Mm-hmm. And if he were here today, you know, one thing about Wells was he always kept changing his mind, and he kept re-editing his own films, and he would do new versions, and he would rethink what he was doing. So what he would do today, who knows what he would do if he were given all this stuff to edit. It would be much different from what he would have done in 1980 or 85, you know?
Right. Yeah. Well, we will have to wait and see. All right, listeners, happy hour's over. Time for the final showdown. To close this thing out, Joe's going to give us an update on two of his major writing projects that have been in the works for a while. Let's start with Joe's recently published collection of pieces from the last 50 years called Two Cheers for Hollywood. Joe, what is this habit of dropping new books on me?
Well, this is one of my secret projects. I like to have some public projects and secret projects that I've been working on some things for a long time. This one I worked on over the years for a long, long time. Obviously, it's the pieces in the book go back to 1967 when I started writing about films. But I was playing around with trying to assemble this into a book in different ways over the years. And I'm very glad I waited till now because I like the form it's finally in. It's got 64 pieces in it. Two Cheers for Hollywood, Joseph McBride and Movies. You can get it only through Amazon. That's how I sell it. And I wrote several new pieces for it, too. A lot of the older pieces some people have read, but some they haven't because they're in obscure or far-flung magazines. And these are the ones that I like best. Interviews with directors, stars, profiles of screenwriters. I'm very proud of some of those. And some essays on some of my favorite films. But I wrote some new material for the book. I wrote an 18,000-word monograph on the Coen brothers, who I love. Oh. I think they're as good as anybody from the golden era. And they haven't been treated properly by critics, I think. So I wrote a long piece on them, and I'm very happy with that. And I've had new pieces on John Ford and John Huston, and a long introduction, and a long piece on John Sanford, who is a blacklisted writer who's kind of obscure but a great writer. He's one of the writers I profile. And I did new introductions for every piece in the book, telling background stories, interesting stories related to how the articles came about and interesting or funny things that happened while I was doing them, or reflections on things that have happened since, you know, and I think those pieces are interesting. So I'd say about a fifth of the book is new, actually, and the rest is a collection. So I'm very, very pleased. Of course, it's a wonderful feeling to have it out after 50 years.
Right.
It seemed like it went by in a flash.
That's depressing. Don't say that.
Yeah. For 50 years from now, you'll say, where did it go?
I know. But yeah, it's nice to have something to show for those 50 years, you know?
Yeah.
Not only do you have this book, but all of the previous books you've published. Very prolific.
Thank you. It's a little like in the Hawks films. When some flyer dies, they pull out a little pile of his belongings and they say, not much to show for 50 years.
You've got a big old satchel.
That's true. This is a long book. It's 695 pages of stuff.
Oh, boy. lots to cover. Yeah. And then not only that, there's still always forward thinking. You've got another book in the works. This one we've talked about on the show before.
Yeah.
But the Lubitsch book.
Yeah. One of my favorite directors. Again, a guy who I know you love and a lot of people who love old classic films worship. Ernst Lubitsch, the great German-American director, and he's neglected somewhat today, although since I started researching him 7 years ago, more and more of his films have come out on DVD and Blu-ray in America. Still, a lot of his films I had to get from Europe, and I had to go to Germany a couple times to see films that are hard to see, and even some of his early Hollywood films are hard to get, but he's just a fabulous director, very wide-ranging, and he more or less invented the romantic comedy and invented the musical as we know it. And his films are delightfully sophisticated, very sexually advanced, and very complex in the treatment of male-female relationships, especially just like Hawks. Hawks worshipped Lubitsch, as did most directors of that period. Wells said Lubitsch was a giant, and Hawks imitated Lubitsch and Preston Sturges and all kinds of people. And so this book is called How Did Lubitsch Do It? The Films of Ernst Lubitsch. And it's in negotiations with publishers right now. And so it'll be out in due course. And so it's finished writing and I feel very happy about it. And hopefully we'll introduce Lubitsch to a lot of people who don't know his work and get excited about him again. That was the goal of writing the book. Plus the fact that I just love his work. I wanted to help make him popular again or more popular than he is now.
Yeah, I'm definitely looking forward to that. And do you anticipate that by the next time you're on the show, it will be out?
Well, it depends on the next. it'll probably be on next year,
okay.
But I'm not sure exactly when. But books take a while, you know, in the editing and all that kind of stuff. But it's in the pipeline, coming along. And, you know, in the meantime, watch a lot of great Lubitsch films like The Smiling Lieutenant and Heaven Can Wait and Trouble in Paradise, especially. I know you love that.
Yeah. They, at this year's TCM Film Fest, I saw So This Is Paris and 1 Hour With You.
Ah.
And I loved both of them.
Those are wonderful movies, and they restored Hysterical. So That It Was Paris, right?
Yeah. So good.
A very inventive filmmaker. You know, he tried something different every time out. Even within his genre, you know, like Hawks, but amazingly creative and inventive. He never tried to do anything the normal way. You know, everything is very sophisticated. And I think they showed The Smiling Lieutenant recently in L.A. too, didn't they?
Did they? They might have. I missed it.
It's a wonderful, wonderful musical that not too many people know. But there's a box set of Lubitsch musicals from Criterion that's fantastic. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and but there are a lot of, you know, one thing I hope, and this happens when I write books, is they will release more and more of his films, you know, that are not available. And some are being restored, like Rosita, his first American film, is being restored by the Museum of Modern Art. And they're also restoring Forbidden Paradise, which is a fantastic silent film he did with Paolo Negri that's really hard to see. And it's coming along. And so, you know, Lubitsch is still active in the pipeline himself.
All right. Lots to look forward to then. And that's the way we frame it. Flicks-wise, that is. Listeners, what do you think of Rio Bravo? Hawks' masterpiece? Or do you have another favorite? Come let us know on our website, flickswise.com. Or you can leave us a comment on Facebook at facebook.com/flickswise. If you think El Dorado or Rio Lobo is better, you should come tell me why on Twitter. The handle is @flickswise. Or if you just want to talk about Hawks, I'm here for that. Okay. Now, I'm afraid I must do something that Mr. Hawks would certainly disapprove of. I must ask you, dear listeners, for help. I need you all to go to iTunes, subscribe, rate us, and let other potential listeners know how much you dig us. Come on. I know it's the cowardly move, but I need you. yeah, do your part. Joe, it was a pleasure having you on the show again.
Well, thank you. It's always great to talk to you, and it's wonderful to be able to talk about old Howard again.
I know. And just to remind listeners, they can pick up a copy of Two Cheers for Hollywood on Amazon. And your book, Hawks on Hawks.
Yeah, that's available from the University Press of Kentucky. It was republished again a few years ago, and it's a really delightful interview book with him. He was a great storyteller and a very wise man about filmmaking, and I think you'll get a real kick out of the book.
All right, listeners, you've got homework. Go do that. And in the meantime, Joe, shall we ride off into the sunset?
Well, yeah, we could play a little real Bravo music. I love the end music, don't you? Just a little song by Dean Martin at the end, maybe.
I do love that song. Well, do you have your guitar?
I can't
do
sing.
It.
Can't sing.
Oh, well.
By the memory of a song, while the rolling Rio Bravo rolls along, while the rolling Rio Bravo rolls on.